Link to the Prop History Podcast.
Have you ever wondered, while watching a movie, where you know that thing from? And wondered why the fuck they're using a coffee grinder to power a DeLorean? That's what we're gonna dive into on the Prop History Podcast.
Well, that was abrupt, but that's fine too. Hello and welcome to the Prop History Podcast. I am your host, Mike.
I'm Greg.
And that's Greg. We are two people who are, we are both prop makers, amateur prop makers, but we are both obsessive about detail in prop making. And I have been a prop maker for about 3 years. Greg, how long have you been a prop maker?
Well, my first prop, this is a story. You want a story?
Yeah,
I want a story. So the first prop I ever made, the first replica prop I ever made came from a movie called The Manhattan Project with John Lithgow. And it was a, so this kid breaks into a nuclear power facility to steal some plutonium. And he does.
Like you do.
Like you do. Because he's building a science project. He's making a nuclear bomb. And he steals a bottle of plutonium, and it was, he literally, in the movie, he literally takes some, like, Prel shampoo and glitter and mixes it together and pours it into a plastic bottle and replaces the plutonium with the Prel. And I'm like, dude, I could fucking do that. So that's how I got into prop making back when I was, like, in seventh grade, which would have been 35 years ago.
That's, yeah, my first prop that I ever made, it really wasn't even a prop. I had been a model builder for about 20 some years, almost 20-30 years, ever since I was a kid, and I didn't really get into building props until a friend of mine got a hold of me and asked me to do a costume for a horse. So,
oh yeah.
So I made an AT-AT from Star Wars for a 2,000-pound Clydesdale.
Tell you how many times I see that picture. And just recently, like, two very different friends are like, I've got to know somebody that knows this dude. I'm like, yep, that's my business partner. Yep.
I know that dipshit. And that conversation that started that was, as you would expect, started over booze. Because the horse owner and I were, and her husband and my wife, that we were all very close friends. And we were all hanging out, just drinking. And her horse, Mona, the horse's name is Mona, she was going to do her last show before she retired from showing, and they had a costume class, and she drunkenly asked me, hey, can you make a costume from a horse? And I thought, you know what, how hard could it be?
Did it win?
It got seventh place, and the reason for that is because I built it. It took about 9 months to build, because we were constantly going back and fitting it to the horse just to make sure that it would work. And then I posted pictures online, and it blew up. It went all over the place. It was in CNET. It was in the New York Post. I didn't expect it to go that far, but everybody who was competing in the costume class was like, "Oh shit, we need to step our game up." And there were a few people that actually came up to me at that show, and they were like, "We weren't putting much effort into it until we saw that picture."
That's awesome.
So then everybody, so if nothing else,
you screwed yourself.
I screwed myself. Yeah. Or I could look at it that I spurned other people's creativity, and I'm going to go with that one instead.
Yeah, that's better.
Yeah, it sounds way better that way.
Side question, can I ride this horse?
You actually can. The horse is still very much alive and well, and we'll introduce you to our friends.
I would like that, because as a Scotsman, I should be on a Clydesdale.
Right? And that was a horrible accent. Please do it again.
So Scotty, you know, doing a Scottish accent, you have to work into that. Like, to me, it's, I get into it through Scotty. It's like, "Hey, sir, yes, yeah, the flux capacitor is not working well," and then you start talking like that, and
yeah. Dreadful. I love it.
This is why I pick up accents really easily. Mm-hmm. And so, like, when I'm in the UK, I purposely don't, because I don't want them.
You'll just start parroting them by mistake, and
yeah, and they'll think I'm making fun of them, and mm-hmm. it's not what I want.
But. And then they'll just start mercilessly making fun of you for it.
Because you sound like Dick Van Dyke from
right,
Mary Poppins.
Yeah, and
hi, Governor. Would you like some tea and crumpets with that?
Oh, that's so bad.
Hartford Errington 8 pickled herrings, eh?
Oh God! After that stupid horse, the stupid horse costume, I ended up getting into cosplay, and then I just because I'm naturally obsessive about detail, I ended up moving into prop making, and now we're actually recording this in my shop, and it's just it's full of all manner of movie props and partially completed movie props and bits and bobs here and there. What are you currently working on,
Greg? What am I not currently working on?
I know you have like 9,000 things going.
Well, this morning I got up bright and early to work on my Jarnac table or the hollow chest table from the Millennium Falcon. I think I'm just about ready to paint that. I'm working on Han Solo frozen in carbonite. I just got all the panels done, but I want to rebuild the box. I'm building a life-size R2-D2. I'm embarrassed to say this. I'm building a replica of the car from Corvette Summer.
Never be embarrassed by that, because what kind of car is it?
It's a 1977 Corvette.
Yeah.
But I've got a bunch of stuff on the, like, I, you know, I'm working on the Fifth Element gun with you and Starship Trooper gun with you. The mother key box from Alien, Viper's helmet from Top Gun. I don't know. I have like 53 things sitting on my desk just waiting to pick. I know.
Yeah, gestures vaguely around my shop.
You got a great little shop here, though. Tiny shop.
I love it. It is Mike's Tiny Shop, which you can find on all social media as at Mike's Tiny Shop. But there's the plug for it right there. I am currently working on the endless project of making portable trackers from 1979's Alien, thanks to you, primarily. And
yay.
Right? I'm sick to death of building them. I've built 7 of them now, and I have shipped out 5 of them.
That's more than I made.
Right? That's more than production made. They only made 4 for production. And then the Bantha Bomb and Detonator from The Mandalorian Season 2 Episode 1,
which is so cool.
It is so cool. This is a bit late, but if you are out there listening and you are one of the few people in the world who has not seen The Mandalorian, spoilers, there will be spoilers because we're about to talk about The Mandalorian, because you have seen the last episode we just talked about.
Yeah, it was great.
Thoughts?
Watched it twice. Oh, it was good. It, you know, total sidetrack. So
this whole podcast is sidetracks. Yeah.
So I watched it and I was like gleeful, and I got online and people were gleeful, and most people were doing pretty good about not sharing spoilers. But I'm seeing all this glee, right? And it's like, oh my God, this is the best writing ever. I'm in love with this. I'm crying. But I freaking get bothered by the fact that he eats the eggs. Mm-hmm. And everybody's like, it's just a TV show. It's not real. And it's like, you're sitting there crying because
nostalgia.
Nostalgia happened last night. And, you know, I don't know. It's good. I like it. I generally like things. Like, I'm generally not that guy that's like, oh God, that was horrible. Let's burn the writers' houses down. And
you, I'm assuming you did also watch the post-credit scene.
I did. I did take issue with it just a little bit. It was beautiful and it was perfect, and I squeed because Matthew Wood reprised his role as Boba Fett, or Bib Fortuna, whatever.
Yeah, right.
So many words. I hit my head on the toilet this morning. It's
he legit did. He like did a header straight into the toilet this morning.
Words are hard today. But like, I rewatched that scene in Return of the Jedi right after that, and I'm like, how the hell did he survive? But I'm glad he did, and I don't care. And I was just tickled pink that Matt reprised his role. He and I are Facebook friends, and I messaged him right away. I'm like, oh my God, I was so happy to see your face. So
I did notice that Bib Fortuna had gotten quite portly in his years.
As one does.
And I was curious if they're going to do the same thing to Boba, because now Boba is in charge of...
Well, Boba's already put on weight.
Well, yeah, Temuera Morrison's, he's older, so, sure. Yeah. But he looks awesome, and that scene where they brought Boba back in his full armor when he drops down like death from above,
yeah,
and just kills the hell out of everything in front of him, I thought that was fantastic. He looked as amazing as he possibly could, and then when they repainted the armor, I didn't think that would make that big of a difference, and it did. It was so much better looking.
I love the armor repainted.
Yeah, like I absolutely do.
For me, it's like, you know, dude gets his car stolen in high school, and he finally tracks it down after 40 years, and he's like, I'm going to AutoZone, and I'm buying the same fucking paint I bought 40 years ago.
I'm getting some rattle cans and spray painting that bitch back.
Yep, so I loved it. I have an old Don Post Boba Fett helmet that's signed by Jeremy Bullock.
Yeah, and who just sadly passed away.
Yeah, I had him sign it twice. I had him sign it once back in like 1997 at one of his first conventions in the States. And I had him sign it at his very last convention in the state because the signature had worn off over the years.
Oh, wow.
And I just... Don't tell my wife. I just ordered the Hasbro Black Series Mandalorian helmet.
I want that so bad.
And
it looks so much more accurate than the Boba Black Series, because the Boba Black Series, the visor's too big, and there's a couple other little differences to it.
But now I really want this new Boba helmet.
Yeah.
Like,
all the freshly painted, but still has the dent in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I love that he didn't bother with that.
No, that dent was earned. And besides, Bondo doesn't stick well to Beskar.
No, I don't think anything sticks well to Beskar. It's like silicone. Only Beskar sticks to Beskar.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to get the Beskar-infused spray paint, the self-etching Beskar paint.
So in case you haven't been able to tell, this is the inaugural episode of the Prop History Podcast. And so far, we've talked very little about prop history. But the reason that Greg and I are sitting in my shop is to record this podcast and talk about one of our favorite films of all time. This is a really terrible segue, but, you know... Turn it off if you don't listen to it.
No, don't turn it off. It gets better.
We promise it will so get better. Is the absolutely wonderful 1997 film Starship Troopers, which was directed by Paul Verhoeven. Greg and I both have quite an affinity for this movie. We have quite a few props from this movie, as a matter of fact. And you actually owned quite a few props from this movie.
Yeah, I had an entire hero costume. It was the... I think it was Sugars, but it was whatever the radio guy who went up to the top of the hill to get a better signal before he got, eaten or got, stabbed. I had his particular costume and, I had one of the, apparently I had a rare hero helmet too that I didn't know. So, but I sold it and, bought a laser cutter and that was probably a good job to do that.
I mean, you ended up with a laser cutter that you've made an enormous amount of stuff with.
Yeah, and I've made my money back.
And you're more of a maker than you are a collector in some regards.
Yeah. For me, definitely it's about making, although I want to own it all. I've come to the conclusion that I'm smog, and I just want to be around all my preciouses. And
yeah, you just want to sit on a hoard of props.
And I do.
Yeah, no, do. I'm not any different than that. But if you've not seen Starship Troopers, it's a 30-year-old movie at this point, or 20-year-old, actually, movie at this point. And spoilers, because we're just going to talk about the production of the film. But Starship Troopers, it was not just a movie. It started out as a book in 1958 by a guy named Robert Heinlein. And he was very right-wing, because the book is rather fascisty. It's all about the military controlling society. And it was, as it turns out, Robert Heinlein actually sort of believed that. And it actually is also the first thing to really popularize power armor as well, the concept of powered armor, which has been just, it permeates almost everything.
Why don't we
now.
Have power loaders now?
Power loaders? I don't, from aliens?
Yeah.
I don't think that they would work, because that thing didn't work at all. I mean, it was not practical in the slightest.
Did you ever see the movie Dave?
Oh, God, yeah.
He does this whole scene with, like, these power loader arms, but they're like, and I caught a fish that's this big.
Oh, yeah, because he's operating the robotic arms through the, what, I can't remember what that stuff's called. It doesn't really matter, does it?
No,
who cares? But in 1997, or rather 1996, when production started, they started with making the movie Starship Troopers. And Paul Verhoeven is not right-wing and fascist at all, and a lot of people were really curious as to why he was going to make a really right-wing, fascist-y seeming movie. And he actually made it to be sort of a parody of all of that.
Satire.
Yeah, very much a that's more accurate.
Satirical.
Yeah, a very satirical version of the book to not try to show that you, because I think in his words there's something along the lines of, you can't tell people that something is evil and have them believe it. You can only show them the most ridiculous version of it. And that's what he did. He made everything super over the top with all the propaganda. The propaganda, would you like to know more? Propaganda commercials that were permeated the movie. And then all the visuals, like the costumes themselves. Every single officer in those in that movie is wearing a uniform that is very evocative of the Nazi uniforms, which was completely on purpose.
Right.
And Paul Verhoeven had direct interaction with those folks because he grew up in occupied Holland from 1938 to 1945. And his house was actually near a V2 rocket facility, a launch facility, when it was actually bombed regularly by British Lancasters during the war.
Oh, wow.
So he actually experienced quite a bit of unpleasantness because of that. And then he was also, he served in the Dutch Navy for 2 years, I believe, during his career. So Paul Verhoeven has a lot of background. He actually hated the book, too. When he tried to read the book, he got about two chapters in, and it was such a hardcore right-wing book, he just couldn't tolerate it. So he actually had a production assistant read it and then tell him the story.
That's fair.
And then when the script was done, he actually hand-drew 4,000 storyboards in preparation for the movie. The guy is serious business when it comes to making a movie. So it's quite a, I remember when it came out, everybody was super excited about it, and everybody was, you know, rah-rah, Starship Troopers is amazing. And even as a 17-year-old, which is now aging me, I thought it was super great. But then go back and watch it as an adult, you know, as I get older, I realize that it's just one huge satire against that that mindset. So.
So for me, Starship Troopers is also one of those movies. It's probably what I would say are the three military movies that are two movies in one. Mm-hmm. Because there's the whole before they get to boot camp movie, which I skip over 90% of the time.
Yeah, because it's nonsense.
And then there's the after boot camp movie, just like in Stripes, where there's the boot camp part, and then there's the, we're going to Germany in an RV, and Full Metal Jacket, which starts off in boot camp, and then, you know, it's like, who cares?
Yeah, Full Metal Jacket is the one that has, like, the hardest transition between, like, it's a very obvious transition between the boot camp movie and then in Vietnam movie. So. Which, by the way, the boot camp part of that was actually filmed in England. That was not filmed at Paris Island.
I was just reading today that Kubrick offered Ed Harris the role of the gunnery sergeant.
The gunnery sergeant?
And he turned it down. So.
Well, the original actor for the gunnery sergeant is actually, that was ultimately played by Arlie Ermey, was actually the M60 door gunner. That was the original actor that was going to play that. But I think Arlie Ermey had been brought in as a military advisor and then recorded like so many hours of him screaming at people.
Because he had done Apocalypse Now, too. Mm-hmm.
Yep. And then they were like, no, we're just going to use you. Because he had actually been a drill instructor in the Marine Corps. So he knew the job, so to speak.
Correct.
But it was a bit more of a, I think it was a bit more of a played up version that he did in that movie.
God, so I hope so.
I didn't experience that with mine, but then I was in the 90s. So, so Starship Troopers. We'll go back to that. it had a budget of, I want to say it was $100 million budget, and then it box office worldwide $121 million, so I think you can call it a success. I don't remember if it was, I think it was critically panned for a lot of different reasons, mostly because people couldn't see past the whole fascist part of it, but didn't see the satire side of it. But it was actually nominated for Best Visual Effects that year.
By the Academy Awards. With that. Was that Phil Tippett that
It was Phil Tippett and... let me check my notes here. Tom Woodruff did the creature design. And, of course, the legendary Phil Tippett of Jurassic Park and Star Wars, Willow, RoboCop.
Everything that you liked.
Everything that matters. Phil Tippett has done it. And I love it that actually in Jurassic Park, the very first one, they were going to actually do claymation for the T-Rex. They were going to do stop action or go motion animation for the T-Rex. And some of that still survives. And it's beautiful footage. But they ended up going CGI instead because the technology had caught up. And it works. It still works today. But Phil Tippett was put in the credits as a dinosaur wrangler.
Oh, that's awesome.
Which led to the meme of, you had one job, Phil. You had one job. And failed miserably at it. So the movie itself, of course, stars Casper Van Dien, Neil Patrick Harris, Clancy Brown, Michael Ironside, Denise Richards, etc. And Michael Ironside's character, who is their teacher and their commander of the Roughnecks, his character is actually
Rico's Roughnecks.
Is actually a conglomeration of two separate characters from the book. their teacher and their commander, so they didn't even bother changing that. They just left him as the same thing, but it was the same guy each time.
Hmm.
Kind of cool. It was filmed in the Badlands of Hell's Half Acre in Natrona, Wyoming.
I was supposed to go there 2 summers ago. But,
really? Yeah, just to go take pictures of the location?
Yeah, I love doing that. Going to vacation, or going to location shoots on vacation.
Right.
But I got the trip got cut short because the wife wanted to come home. So.
Well, that's fair. And then I think the rest of the visual effects, like the human visual effects, like the corpses and all the blood work and stuff, was actually done by Kevin Yager, who did Freddy Krueger's makeup. And then he also did The Crypt Keeper. He's famous for both of those. I just have to keep looking at my notes because that's all I know. Now, let's talk about the props from the film. And the most recognizable props from the film are, of course, the armor, which you owned
yes.
a set of. And then the weapons.
Yeah.
So now the armor, as I understand it, was bespoke. It was made specifically for the movie.
Yeah, I want to say Max Cervantes was the one that, I don't know if he designed it or just made it for the production company, but that was all, everything was custom, and it was so custom, and they made so much of it, they used it in 8 million other things.
Yeah, they actually made 1,000 separate helmets for the film. And like you said, they've been seen in Firefly, several episodes of Firefly, and also Power Rangers, Last Stand. It shows up there quite often.
Go, Power Rangers.
Right? most of their web gear, though, the belts and stuff like that, were all made by a company called Eagle Industries.
Okay.
And it's all off-the-shelf stuff, because they had to supply essentially 1,000 separate costumes.
Now, have you ever actually seen screen-used armor?
I have only seen pictures of screen-used armor.
So how it's made is, so the outer part of the armor is a rubber skin, and then it's filled in with a black expanding foam.
Mm-hmm.
So then you have these sheets, and then the webbing is all held down by pop riveted on metal plates.
Right.
And then there's the clippy things that, you know, put on the sides and the pouches and stuff. So I don't know which direction you're going, but I'm just going my direction. So
you
like
do you, bud.
Like in one of the pouches is lemon cakes.
Yep.
And I know that there's glow sticks. And the hand grenades on mine were made out of foam. The extra clip was made out of foam. There was a water bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And then I only had a blank knife, so it wasn't edged and it didn't have a tip.
Yeah, and I guess most of them, except for the ones used by Clancy Brown, were that way, because nobody ever really took them out of the pouch. They did, like Casper Van Dien did in one scene, but for the most part they were all the unfinished knives. And then those pouches were actually the Eagle MP5 was it the MP5SK pouch with a throwing knife pouch on. No idea why infantry are issued throwing knives. It seems unnecessary because you're losing your weapon when you do that.
Didn't you watch the movie,
man?
You can't push the button without if your hand's disabled.
Well, yeah, because that was Jake Busey that had his arm stuck in a wall while the rubber arm was outside of it.
Put your arm up there, soldier.
Filled with blood capsules, so it would spew out.
I've met Jake.
Have you?
Yeah, he's a super nice guy.
That's cool.
I've met him, Patrick Muldoon, who played Xander. I've met I forget her name. Chick who plays Dizzy.
Oh, good Lord. What is her name?
What is her name? And
Deanne Myers?
Myers.
Dean Myers.
Dina Myers, yeah.
Oh, goodness. And, of course, all of that equipment that we're talking about here, like the Nalgene bottles, like their canteens, the pouch has never been identified. Nobody knows what that one actually is. And the Nalgene bottle underneath has never been seen on screen. Like pictures of them post-production have been seen. But for the most part, nobody knows really what that pouch is or where it came from. But you can find things that are close to it. If you wanted to make your own, you'd need to look up the stuff made by Eagle, which is now a defunct company. I think it was purchased by Blackhawk, and now Blackhawk is defunct.
The armor, I think, would be... I mean, I know people have done replica armor, but I think that would be harder to do to make it right.
Apparently, the armor is one of the hardest parts to find, because it got used so much over and over again by different productions, and then it's just deteriorated over time, much like the radio backpacks, which were bespoke. The hero ones are made of fiberglass with some red LEDs in them. And then the stunt ones were made from just rubber, but they all deteriorated quickly.
Mine was in really good condition.
And for those of you who might be listening and not sure what we're talking about, there's two different types of props. There's the hero prop and the stunt prop. The hero prop is what you see up close. It's made out of much more durable materials. It has much more detail to it. And it's intended to be worn by the main actors in up-close shots. So it looks exactly like it was supposed to. Stunt props tend to be made out of rubber or some sort of other cast material that it doesn't have as much detail, but looks good from a distance. And when we say hero or stunt, that's what we're talking about. Stunt props are more common because more were made. Hero props are less common because fewer were made right. And have more detail.
Here, random story. I want to say it was one of the Star Trek movies, with the next gen. Mm-hmm. There's a scene where Data is playing with the tricorder, making it talk.
Yeah.
And I guess Brent Spiner threw that tricorder across the room. And they had to shut down production because they didn't have a backup.
So it was the only hero.
Yeah, they had to make another one.
What is it? The Hateful Eight. The Tarantino. Oh, the guitar. They handed Kurt Russell the wrong guitar to break, and it ended up being an antique guitar that was worth quite a bit of money.
Yeah, I guess Martin said they'll never loan another guitar ever again.
Because it came from their museum, didn't it?
Yeah.
Movies.
I don't think it was that, honestly, that they handed him the wrong guitar. I don't think he was supposed to smash it, is the story that I read.
Okay.
Like, just...
On a similar note, the old, I think it was 1970s era film, The Desert Fox, which is about Erwin Rommel in the desert against the British. Yeah. His family actually loaned the production one of his original uniforms. So the actor, who I cannot remember the actor's name that played Erwin Rommel, is actually wearing one of Erwin Rommel's uniforms in that.
Wow.
And at the end of production, the family went to go get it back, and they're like, oh, we didn't mark which one it was. It's now in a prop house somewhere, and it still is. And to this day, Erwin Rommel's original uniform is hanging around in a prop house somewhere.
Jeez.
Yeah, don't loan things to Hollywood productions is what it sounds like.
Well, the other side to that is it used to be, I don't think you can do it so much these days, but it used to be you could go to a prop house and rent stuff. Mm-hmm. And you would pay the rent, the deposit, and you'd be like, oops, I accidentally lost this prop. Because, like the PKE meter from Ghostbusters, like, you know, that was used in other things. It gets returned back to the prop house, and then they rent it out to the next thing. And somebody knows what that is and goes in and is like, I want to rent that thing. And, okay, the deposit's $200, and if I lose it, I'm out $200. Okay, well, that sucks. And
yeah, well, I just got a sweet prop for $200. I don't know what the process is for renting from them anymore, but I imagine it's... It's not as easy.
Props are now art. Like it, I don't think that happens anymore.
Right.
I think, you know, if people in production see a value of it, they are either going to hold on to it or they'll auction it off. Like,
and I've only been in the prop community, prop collecting community, prop making community for a few years. Have you noticed in your time in it that it has become more popular recently?
Oh God, yes. Like I remember when the replica prop forum, the RPF. I mean, there were just, you know, I started back in 1997, and I mean, if there were 100 of us, I'd be surprised. And now there's tens of thousands of people. And I mean, you look at these profiles and history auctions and Prop Store of London, like, it's just amazing the, not only the quality of props that they're getting to sell, but the insane prices that these props are going for. And, you know, I think back to, I have some screen use pieces that I've acquired over the years, and I've sold a number of them because I'm not as much of a collector as a builder, as you pointed out. And people will be like, oh, so do you have a COA with this? And I'm like, no. And they're like, well, I don't want it without a COA. I'm like, when I got this dude, we made fun of people who had COAs because that was just some guy with a printer who put something on a piece of paper. Like, I can tell you who I got this from. I can tell you who they got it from. And if that's not enough for you, then you're passing up a really good opportunity to own something really cool.
Yeah. And for those who don't know, COA is a certificate of authenticity, which anymore, a lot of folks associate all of the value of a prop with those COAs.
Yeah. It's crazy. Like I'll read people like, oh yeah, I frame mine and put it up on the wall. It's like, you're framing a piece of paper that doesn't mean anything.
I keep mine in a box.
Like I don't even know that anything I have really has a COA. If I do, it's just ancillary. And
I've seen some COAs laying around on the floor in your shop. That's really where Greg's at with them.
That's true. Yeah, it's not that I don't value. I just don't value them. If it doesn't matter to me. If I can prove without a shadow of a doubt that it came from production, then that's all I care about.
Yeah, you know it came from there. And I mean, you do hang on to stuff for a while too, so.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, how long did you have those Mangalore armor pads before I bought them from you?
A long time, 15 years probably. Yeah. At least 15 years.
Yeah. So I have no doubt that they came from production whatsoever. So
yeah, and I got them from Prop Store of London. Yeah. Actually, I got those because I was doing some trades with them back in the day. I was the first person ever to do replicas of the Jurassic Park DNA can, and I traded them like three or four cans in exchange for some props that they had.
Speaking of a first that you've done, weren't you also one of the first people to do R2s as well? The
Astromectroids? Yeah, I mean, definitely one of the first. Mm-hmm. I mean, not the first, but yeah. So I was.
How many Astromechs do you think you've built?
I've built probably five or six full ones, but I think Statue of Limitations is probably worn out for this. I've probably sold, I'm gonna say over those years, probably 50 plus kits, and probably parts for, I mean, at least another 100 droids. So,
So you've moved quite a bit of stuff.
Yeah.
In the Astromech market.
Yeah, so back in the early days. It's funny because I have a good friend that's real big into the R2 builders world, and I've got one of my original R2s. It's an R5 actually, but it's the one with the bad motivator sitting in my shop, and he desperately wants it because it's a part of R2 builder history.
Right.
I'm like, I mean, that's cool to think that I'm a part of R2 builder history,
although right,
somewhat nefarious part. But
well, I'm the only moron to ever build an AT-AT costume for a Clydesdale, so.
Well, there you go.
I have my own claim to fame.
See?
Take that.
We all got to have a place in life.
That's right.
You do really good Expanse stuff.
Yeah. I actually, the vac suit that I built for the Expanse, and then the exoskeleton, which I think I'm one of the only a few people to ever build Drummer's exoskeleton from season 3 for a friend of mine out in Virginia.
Nice.
For Suzanne. The props master from the Expanse, Jim Murray, contacted me and said, hey, would you like a set of production-made graphics to go on that thing? And
yes,
I was like,
please.
Am I being trolled? Who are you? Are you really Jim Murray? I don't believe you. But after realizing that he was who he says he was, he sent me all of the graphics they used, which was awesome.
I have found that artists really respect other artists, and it's like, if what I'm doing as an artist can make you a better artist, or you know, like, they're pretty good people.
Yeah. I mean, and not to push the Expanse too much, but I'm gonna every chance I get, they're extremely good to their fan base as well. In the most recent season, which season 5 just started, the fans of the Expanse are referred to as the Screaming Firehawks because of a single line that was spoken in the first season of the movie, of the series. And when there's a scene on Mars where they walk into a bar and there's an advertisement for Firehawks whiskey, and it's a straight up shout out to the fan base of the Expanse, which is awesome because there are very few shows that will ever do something like that.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Maybe when this podcast takes off and you become really famous, you can get a walk on. And
well, they actually announced that season 6, the next season that they're in pre-production with right now, is going to be the last one on Amazon.
So we got to get famous real quick.
Yeah, we got to get famous super fast. So tell all your friends. But going back to Starship Troopers, we've talked about the mobile infantry uniforms, their armor, their props, that are a lot of off-the-shelf stuff. All of their boots are actually Adidas Trekker shoes.
With spats on them.
With some spats made out of suede. It's all because, like, again, they had to outfit 1,000 people, more or less, at least 1,000 different costumes. They get to the most famous part of all of their kit, which is, of course, the Merida rifle.
Love that gun.
Yeah. Now, there's two, three versions of the Merida rifle, actually, that were built. You have your stunt and your hero, which we already talked about. And then, of course, the practical. And practical props are blank firing guns. And in the case of the Merida rifle, it's kind of funny that within the movie, Paul Verhoeven wanted to sort of evoke the World War II aesthetic, in that this super advanced society that can travel into space, to travel to different planets, still uses cased ammunition firearms and drops bombs. That there's no more advanced technology than that when it comes to warfare. So there's a lot of visuals that evoke World War II, not just the uniforms, but also the landing ramps coming down on the landing craft, which is supposed to sort of be a callback to the landing ships of World War II. But in the book, the guns are actually listed as being chambered in 7.62 by 51. That's a specific call out, which is 308 NATO, a modern cartridge. They're actually chambered in 5.56 because they're really just dressed up what are called AC-556K, made by Ruger. It's the fully automatic version of a Mini 14.
Those of you out there can't see my eyes glassing over because I have no idea what he's talking about.
They're the specific type of weapons. This is something that I care about, Greg.
No, I care about it because you care about it. Right. I have no idea what you're talking about.
And then they were actually just wrapped in a modified Muzzlelite MZ-14 bullpup stock, which was actually a commercial stock at the time. And then there was an Ithaca Model 37 shotgun put underneath them, and then they had an M60 flash suppressor on the end. And then everything was just kind of modded up after that just to make it look pretty. But there was a semi-auto firing version and then a full auto firing version of it. And one of those semi-auto firing versions actually went up for sale recently through a prop store. And then the guns on the tower were just modified 50 caliber machine guns. But those are the guns used.
That now, was did they it. Use the same gun for both the fleet and the long Merida?
No, the fleet one is actually a cut down version of the Merida, but it still uses the AC-556 or Mini 14 inside of it. It's still just a bullpup Mini 14 is all they are. But I don't know how many practicals were actually made for the movie. But I know a few of them still survive. And a lot of the stunts still survive.
We should make one.
We should. The joke's on us because Greg is actually sitting right next to the mold that we have. Really? For it's right there. Right down there.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, there it is. There's actually two molds for Merida rifles in this shop. The old mold that he had, which is not in the best of shape anymore, and then the one I just recently made, which is it makes pretty decent ones. The Merida rifles, the stunt Merida rifles, they were made of rubber, weren't they?
Yes.
And they were made...
like a self-skinning rubber.
Yeah, they were made so fast. I actually got to talk to one of the guys from production who worked on making the rifles for it. They made them so fast that half of them were immediately pulled from the mold and thrown in the trash. They were so badly done.
I wonder what the cure time on that, like how long they had to leave those in.
I don't know, but my understanding, the way he told the story was, is that the prop department made the mold and then some other guys came in to cast them. And it was a matter of they didn't have enough time. It was too hot outside and they just, like, it wasn't the ideal situation to cast these rifles. So half of them straight in the trash. And you can actually see in some of the major battle scenes, some of the guys in the background actually just have cardboard cutouts because they didn't have enough rifles to make it work. But in movie magic, that works.
Right.
And then you only, you know, all the practical ones, they're kept by the armorers until they're needed for specific scenes. But otherwise, everybody's just carrying either, like the main actors would carry the heroes.
Right. So the mold that you had, that I gave you, mm-hmm. was molded off of a background rubber one. And those were so warped to hell. That when that got molded, all of that warping was transferred over into that mold. And so what I did was I poured a resin casting of that and tried to straighten it up. And that's what you've been working on and mm-hmm. straightening up.
Yeah, and eventually we'll get it to the point where it's the goal, of course, is to make it as close to a hero as possible so that we have hero versions of both. Well, actually, excuse me, all four on-screen different variants. The black one, which is a standard Merida rifle painted black, the green one that you see all the infantrymen carry, and then the DMR, the one with the big scope on it, the designated marksman rifle, and then the short carbine.
Because it's my favorite.
Because we're obsessive enough that we have to have all four versions of the same gun.
Yeah.
Because why not? And we also both make molds, so we can get away with doing that for ourselves. Well, we've talked about as much as we can about Starship Troopers. Is there anything else you want to talk about? Because the props, I mean, other than like the model work and the special effects stuff, which was amazing, because like the ship models, I think it took a year for them to make all the ship models for it. And some of them were enormous. So it was the same folks, I think, that built the Event Horizon filming models as well.
The Roger Young.
The Roger Young, yeah. They got blowed up.
It's all right.
Yeah, torn in half, didn't it?
So you know why they made Starship Troopers 2, right?
No.
Because they already had the CGI for the... for the bugs.
Well, they also had all the props laying around for it too. Yeah. They had so damn many.
And I want to say, who directed Starship Troopers 2? Was that Phil Tippett?
I don't know.
It We'll have to do this with a
we're gonna laptop. We might edit this part out, or we might make you listen to us both getting on our phones. Laptop.
But I want to say that like Starship Trooper 2 was directed by like
one of the special effects guys.
And I want to say it was Phil Tippett, but they had all of the stuff, so they're like, yeah, let's go ahead and do it. You know,
might as well give us some money.
Phil Tippett directed.
Was it Phil Tippett?
Yeah.
So going back a little bit, Phil Tippett did all the creature effects, most of the creature effects for the original Starship Troopers, and as well as a thousand other movies that matter, Jurassic Park, Star Wars, etc. So yeah, Phil Tippett is. There was actually just a Phil Tippett collection auction on Prop Store. And among it were his stop motion RoboCop 2, the Kane.
Oh yeah,
maquette, which I really wanted, but it went for astronomical amounts of money.
I don't know which one of Tom Spina's companies is it, Regal Robot or Tom Spina Designs? But I think it's Regal Robot. It did a Phil Tippett version of the Tauntaun.
Mm-hmm.
That was a signed version. That was really cool.
That's cool. So they just recently did a Jabba.
Yeah,
that I would love to have.
Yeah,
because I think it was based on the concept art, wasn't
yes.
it? Yeah, it was one of the early concept art ones. Not when he was a dude, though.
No, not the big guy in the
fursuit. Yeah. Which I always thought that was funny when they added that into the special editions.
Oh my god!
Because of course, for those of you who are unaware, the original Jabba the Hutt was actually a dude. And there was a scene in the landing bay with the Millennium Falcon.
I want to say like something like the guy's name was like Angus McFadden or something.
Yeah, like the most Scottish name you can have. And it was him and Han Solo interacting about money. And of course, this was before they had finished up the puppet for the slug version of Jabba the Hutt, as we've all come to know and love. And when they added it in, of course, they added in a bunch of unnecessary CGI while doing it. And he steps over Jabba's tail, which, of course, when they filmed it, there was no tail, so it looks like this South Park-level animation of just
boop, boop, boop.
He's just up and down, and it's beautiful.
Declan Mulholland is his name.
That's as Scottish name as you can get.
Oh, no, he's Irish.
Is he?
It's Declan Mulholland.
Is it?
Because he's from Belfast.
Belfast?
Belfast, Ireland.
Belfast.
Yeah.
I've not been to Belfast.
It's nice.
I've been to Cork. I've been to Dublin, all of the typical touristy places, but
we did a day trip up there and went to the Titanic Museum. And,
oh, that would be cool.
Yeah, because
are there? They have relics of the Titanic in there, don't they?
Yes, sure.
Yeah, some of the relics brought up. That's kind of neat. Oh goodness,
we didn't spend much time there. Although I did buy a replica of the Heart of the Ocean there.
Oh, that's cool. So. Is it screen accurate?
It's nice. I mean, for what it is, it's really nice.
Yeah.
It's not the J. Peterman version, but I have that. One of these days, I want to get that frame with my drawing. My drawing.
Your drawing.
And
another staple.
Yeah.
This.
I think I keep playing with the same staple.
Well, there's staples and razor blades all over the shop, so don't walk in here barefoot. All right. Well, we are at the 45-minute mark.
All right. Sounds like a good time to...
This is a good time to stop making people listen to us, isn't it?
Right.
All right. Well, this has been the Prop History Podcast. We thank you for listening, and...
Please tune in. It'll get better. I promise. Yeah.
If you want to check out some of the work that I or Greg do, you can find our work posted on the Instagram for Prop History Podcast. That's at Prop History Podcast. And also my work at Mike's Tiny Shop or facebook.com/makesthings.
And mine is Instagram at Greg, GREGG.NOWLING.
You'll be able to find links for all of our nonsense down below in the description. And thank you again for listening. Cheers.
Bye.